Is it about the Post? Is it about the Times?
Right, right.
Is it about Tom Hanks? Is it about Meryl Streep? Why is Bob Odenkirk in there? That's nice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for January 2018. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by my fellow cinephile and friend, Tim Nelson. Tim, it's great to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Yes. Glad to be here.
How you doing, man? Anything new in the old Nelson household?
No. My life is just like, it's like a clock.
I hate it when people ask me that. Like, if I haven't seen him in 4 months, I'm like, what's new? I'm just like, think to my kids instantly, and I'm like, nothing.
I'm like, I'm 40 years old. Nothing ever changes.
Exactly.
It's this way for the next 10, 15 years.
I'm locked in. Yeah. This is my life. Yeah.
My hopes and dreams are all basically gone now.
Yes, exactly.
This is my life. The podcast is the highlight of every month.
I thought it was just me.
No.
Oh, no. Gosh. Well, I've had a bit of a busy week because my mom and my wife have the same birthday.
That's just creepy.
That was 2 days ago.
What is that saying? Is there some Oedipal thing going on?
I've been trying to figure it out for however long I've been married, but it's crazy and it's hard to make both two most important women in my life feel valued.
You feel divided?
It's a lot of work. Sometimes I feel divided, but it was another successful year. So
excellent. Know. Happy birthday to them both.
Happy birthday to my wife Emily and my mom Patty. There you go. So Tim, the Oscars are like a month away. We're here. We're in it. Nominations were announced on the 23rd. I even took the liberty of printing off a little list for us.
So John, can I ask you a philosophical question about the Oscars here?
Okay.
Do the Oscars exist to serve the film community, or does the film community exist to serve the Oscars?
I believe that the Oscars truly exist to serve the film community. I think it is a celebration of the movies every year. And there's been a lot of backlash to, like, the Grammys,
yeah, you know? Because it's crap.
Yeah. And I think, like, the common reaction is that it's totally disconnected from, like, what's actually good. And, like, it's, you know, they have the same acts every year that are, like... And I think that people agree that the movies, the Oscars get it right. They generally, you know, there's always going to be some head-scratchers when it comes to the nominations. But I think overall, people generally agree that the right movies were nominated, and that the night is it's a special time for those who love film. So
somehow in Hollywood we managed to have, like, respect artistic integrity is what you're saying.
Yeah. And, like, if you look at this list of nominees, like, there was, you know, last year it was Oscars So White, right? That was the big campaign, and they made action to bring more minorities and people of color into the fold, and it's reflected in the nominees this year. So that's a pretty quick turnaround. I mean, it's still not perfect.
So it's responsive to the film community.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
See?
All right. I was just curious. I never thought about it.
Yeah.
I figured you'd have an opinion.
Yeah, well, it's a very biased opinion because I've been watching the Oscars since I was like 5 years old. So it's like the most special evening of the year for me. Yeah.
I've watched film for a long time, and I never thought about really watching the Oscars. I had friends that would do Oscar parties and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I would go, oh, that's okay. It's surprising. But I usually took a film like not... I didn't think of it as leading to something.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Like an award, or will it beat out? That's much more...
Uh-huh.
But since I've been doing following sports, this is like, you know, who will win? Who will duke it out? And who will win this competition?
Right. And that's one way to look at it. To me, and that's the way, like when I do my big Oscar write-up, I always frame it as who should win rather than who will win, because the whole, like, horse race of it just drives me crazy. But to me, the whole night, it doesn't matter who wins, the whole night is just a celebration of, like, why we do this, why we have this podcast, why we write about film. It's just, it's a love letter to movies. That's what I love about the Oscars. So,
all right, man.
So here we are. So if you look at this list, you took the liberty of going through it and marking it up. You've got your picks. What, like, is there something that just screams out at you as, like, a surprise or...
we're looking at a list of Oscar nominated. These are all the categories.
All the categories.
What stands out to me, I think that Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri is nominated in so many different categories.
Too many.
Was really surprising to me because you and I didn't review this film.
No, but we saw it together.
But we saw it.
Yeah.
And I was so excited, and I came in like starry eyed and like totally biased.
You were sold on the trailer,
Well, the trailer had such good dialogue, it did. And I was super excited about it from a script standpoint. Uh-huh. We got in there, and it was flat.
It was in some ways,
and I was just really surprised. It's almost like this film wishes it was Fargo.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, there's other films to compare it to. Mm-hmm. Of course, that is the immediate one because which makes sense, but.
Three Billboards deserves no nominations, but it is nominated for quite a lot.
I don't know about that. I thought Sam Rockwell was good.
Oh, you're right. Sam Rockwell was the highlight of that for me. You're right. I'll give you that. But Best Picture, it doesn't belong. And I'm worried because it was like the runaway hit of the Globes, you know, which isn't always a predictor, but it does factor into things. And so I just don't want this movie to win Best Picture. That would be a travesty. But yeah, I'm with you on that. Here's what bothered me, and we actually talked about this on the last show, Tim Nelson. Look at actress in a supporting role.
I see it. What's bothering
you? Why is Octavia Spencer in that category? I just don't understand it. It's just like we talked about with Shape of Water. We're not against her. She's delightful
to
watch.
Actress.
She's a good actress. I don't get these roles that she's been nominated for, these performances. Last year it was for what was that movie about the space program? Now I'm totally blanking. But
Hidden Figures.
Last year was for that,
movie.
Which is a fantastic movie, but I thought Tajari Henson was the one who deserved that nomination, the main character, not Octavia Spencer. And this year is even worse. Her role in Shape of Water did not scream Oscar to me, and I don't get it.
This was what I said when we talked about this previously.
Yeah.
My beef was that they didn't write her a good enough character to get into this support.
It's not her, right? It's just not a meaty character, right? Exactly.
It's not. It's kind of like almost like a foil.
Yeah.
So I was like really surprised with a character who wasn't that great of a character that they kind of needed to develop the other characters.
Yes.
That she would win for something like that, because it looks like some of these other characters are like really significant figures in the plot. Like they don't just help to develop the other characters.
I know. Sigh.
I know.
But what else we got? Get Out was a surprise. I did not think it would get director, picture, and the whole nine yards. That's impressive. Now, I know we have our arguments about that movie. I still stand by the fact that it's a grade B horror comedy that is elevated by a very timely topic that we all should be talking about, but I do not think it deserves all the love it's getting. But
I disagree.
It's okay.
I think that we mentioned this, we reviewed it.
We reviewed it, yeah.
We did mention that it actually is creating, it is potentially has created a new genre, which to me is like, that's altering the whole, all of film. Right?
Right. But does that make it a good movie?
Well, I've also watched it several times.
You have? Okay.
And it's more complex than I had assessed it.
To be fair, I've only seen it once, so you probably are more on this.
So it has so many double meanings and so many... the dialogue is so intentionally written that... when you watch it second and third time, you begin to appreciate like how much is there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say it's a good film. I don't know, like from a technical standpoint, I don't see it like measuring up to some of the other films.
Right. What else we got here? Phantom Thread. You haven't seen Phantom Thread yet.
So I haven't had time.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I saw it last week and I loved it. P.T. Anderson is so back. Like, he had a few duds in the middle there. There was The Master, which I wasn't sold on, and then that one trippy drug movie with Joaquin Phoenix, which was okay.
I like that
movie. Inherent Vice. It was okay. But this one is just a return to form. It is so beautiful to look at. Just the technical mastery of it. Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead gets the score, and it's so well acted. Story's super peculiar. There's no question, like the story and the characters are just like, what? But, like, it's a feast for film fanatics.
For 90s people.
Yes. For what?
I'm like, oh, it's Radiohead scored. It's P.T.
it's
Anderson.
It's not Radiohead. It's Johnny Greenwood.
Okay,
big
so it's not, like, Tom.
Yeah.
But, like, so, yeah, but it has, like, all, it's, like, drawing on all these 90s icons. And then you have Daniel Day-Lewis, who's 80s and 90s icon.
Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis helped write the script. specifically because...
Because that's the only way he'd work on this project.
Probably.
He's like, P.T. Anderson's not good enough for me. I need to like help write this thing.
No, it was the other way around. P.T. Anderson was like, he wanted to set it in England, and he was like, you know, I don't want to write like a, you know, Santa Monica dude.
Yeah. So. That's fair.
Yeah.
No, I don't actually know anything about it.
Okay.
I would have loved to review it instead of this film that we're reviewing.
Oh, no. Spoiler alert. Tim doesn't like the movie we're going to be talking about today.
I don't.
It's okay. But you're probably going to see it, right? Hopefully in time for the Oscars. It's so good.
Yeah, I wanted to see it a while back. It's just, you know, my kids were puking and stuff.
I hear you. It went through our house, too. And then, I don't know, Lady Bird, man. I predicted when we did our Lady Bird podcast that Lady Bird would be nominated in all the major categories, and it was. Writing, directing, actress, supporting. Boom! Lady Bird.
Was still, that wrong?
No. You didn't counter it, but I knew. When I saw that movie, I knew that that was the one, and I still think it's the best movie of the year, which, of course, you disagree with, and that's fine.
You're starry-eyed millennial.
It could be a millennial thing, but I'm not alone.
A journey of self-discovery.
Oh,
is that enough for a plot?
Here we go. You know, it was on the cover of the latest Entertainment Weekly, and it said, "Will Lady Bird?" You know, like,
wow,
like,
that's the only way those underdog... old people are going to find it. It has to be on a magazine,
anyway,
because we wouldn't have known about it otherwise.
All right. Well, okay. So, if Lady Bird is not your pick, what is, Tim Nelson? What do you want to win? If you look at this best picture, yes, for best picture.
Shape of Water.
Okay, briefly, what's your reasoning for why that is the best film of the year?
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It deals with, it's a fairy tale, which I like. Because we I think that there's not enough of that, magical realism that we have in Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
I like that it deals with imbalance of power, which to me is like, especially with women. And also, I think it's highly relevant to our kind of
Me Too movement.
Times.
Sure.
To Me Too, but also to immigration, to just the whole idea of how do we respond to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very timely. Well written, and then like I said, it's beautiful. The cinematography that we talk about, production design.
Ah, so technical masterpiece, no question. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's quirky.
Yeah, it's a little too quirky for me. That's the thing. It's not my top 10. There's no question. It's just like it's the lower place because it's a little too quirky for me. But that's okay.
I think I look at it as being more sophisticated than some of the other films.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that goes a long way in Hollywood, but I guess it win the Golden Globe, right?
It did not.
It
he won for Best Director,
oh, that's
but three billboards took home the trophy
ridiculous.
For Best Drama.
Okay,
and
whatever.
I know. It'll be really interesting just to see what's going to win. I mean, Dunkirk, like, let's not forget how great of a movie Dunkirk is. And, you know, if you look at the history of the Academy Awards, war movies tend to do pretty well. So I don't know. I think it's between Dunkirk... And Shape of Water and Three Billboards. I wish Lady Bird was in the running, but I will admit that it's probably not going to win, but it would be delightful. We'll see.
Dunkirk. Is this like another case of if you release a movie too early, you lose the steam for the Academy Awards? because like clearly
right.
to me, like visually, like
yeah.
it's superior to almost everything, maybe Shape of Water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, from a technical standpoint, I honestly am probably going to give Christopher Nolan my pick for Best Director because it's just, you forget, like, you're right, and you're right, it came out, what, like,
July,
something like that? You forget just how stunning of an experience it was and how technically with, like, the editing, with him going back and forth between the three different storylines and how they all converge. Beautiful films.
So the question is, did anyone who actually votes on this see it in 70 millimeter?
Yeah.
Because I think it does make a difference.
It does. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. All right. Well, that's the Oscars. It's going to be great, and we got a little surprise announcement at the end of the show, which we'll share about the Oscars, which involves Tim and someone else. So,
is he going to be surprised to me?
You got to stay tuned. Yeah, it might be. You've probably forgotten already.
Yeah, it's because I'm old. I'm a Gen Xer.
So, all right, the reason I brought up the Oscars, besides the fact that it's, of course, super interesting to all of us who love film, is that we are actually reviewing an Oscar-nominated movie today, Tim, and that is, of course, The Post. Tim's looking at me like, why are we reviewing the post?
I don't usually struggle to like have words for things, but this is, yeah, I've got problems already.
It's okay. So the Post has received two nominations, Best Actress for Miss Meryl Streep and Best Picture. No nomination for director Steven Spielberg or Tom Hanks. We'll talk to that in a minute. So the Post, Tim, now you texted me on your way out of the theater, and it's fair to say that your opinion, your first glance opinion was not very favorable.
Okay.
And it doesn't appear that it's gotten any better over time.
The Post is this, okay? This is the way I'm going to describe this thing. Okay. Imagine all the movies get to, we're all on the playground and everyone's picking their team for dodgeball, okay?
Oh, geez. Here we go.
The Post has all the best players in it. It has every possible, like, if somebody had stacked a team and totally cheated and like, basically had handpicked, cherry-picked all the best players, that is this movie. It's like everyone, there's like not a single weak player in the movie. You've got John Williams, you've got Steven Spielberg, you got Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. It's just like, you already know. It's like proven, it's an all-star team.
Yeah, it's the recipe for success.
And it comes out and it's okay. That's how I would say this is my first.
Yeah.
And so when you have something that is like has that many positives, it's that highly, there's so much talent in that, and then it just is okay, it can be a real letdown.
So you almost like it less just because it had so much potential. It almost hurts it even more in your mind.
It's kind of, it's just stacked. The movie's stacked.
Yeah, it is.
It's got everything. It's like if you had all the power in Hollywood, what would your movie have? And it has all of
that's it. That's everything you want. Well, this is going to be a great podcast because I liked it a lot more than you. And so we are going to get into some tense discussion, and I love it. That's what makes a good show. It actually made my top 10 in 2017, near the bottom, but it's on my top 10. So I really like this movie. So here we go, man. All right. First, though, for as a happy birthday to my mom, we will describe the plot because she's always like, I don't even know what the movie's about. And you talk about it for like an hour.
Do you know if you're going to review a film, you're like the actual like format, like there's technical formats for writing reviews?
Yeah, I'm glad I don't know that.
How long have you had a website?
No.
Well, you're supposed to have a summary in there.
That would trip me up.
You're supposed to say, should I see this or should I not? And there should be a summary of the film.
See, that's what I'm worried about. That's why I don't listen to any other film podcast, because I'm worried there is some format that I'm supposed to be following and I'll just feel intimidated. So I just forget it.
Well,
just do my own thing.
Now you Well, you already are following it.
All right, good.
Somewhat.
We're following it.
Yeah.
So The Post takes place in 1971. Were you alive in 1971?
Not even close.
Okay. But you were in the 70s, right? Your 70s birthday? 78. Jeez, the tail end. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Hey, I got Jimmy Carter. Not Nixon.
Well, I was an 80s boy, so I have a secret fantasy of growing up in the 70s, of like of being in my 20s in the 70s. Like, it just feels like this time where, you know, you had, like, music-wise, Dylan, you know, like late 60s and 70s, it's like the peak of him, and feels like people were just partying and like it was loose. It was like before all the consequences, you know, kicked in the 80s, and everyone was like, yeah, that
I'm
kills
feeling
me.
Like you're describing P.T. Anderson.
I'm describing Boogie Nights.
Yeah, you are. You're like, it's like the narration of Boogie Nights right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So, it's probably complete ignorance, because of course it wasn't like some free for all time. The Vietnam War was going on during this time, and that forms the major backdrop for The Post, because basically, The Post is about the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers was an internal government study that was conducted on the Vietnam War. And the reason why it was significant was that the Pentagon Papers was basically a complete contradiction to the public face of the war. Everything that Nixon and his posse was saying about the war was completely contradicted in these top secret papers, which were never supposed to be released. It was like just an internal study.
And Johnson. And Kennedy.
Yes.
And Truman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it goes that far. You're the history buff here, so you got to correct me when I'm. You got to correct me when I'm wrong.
No, you're doing fine.
Okay.
I'm just saying, like, but it comes to light at that point. Well, yeah, it wasn't supposed to.
Yeah. Right.
Go ahead.
And there's a government leaker who basically gets this out to not the Post, not the Washington Post, but the New York Times. And the New York Times prints some of the Pentagon Papers. And immediately the Nixon administration rears its ugly head and says, no, we're going to sue you and you are barred from printing anything more. And that puts the Washington Post, which is like this sort of, at this time, like a baby up-and-comer publication who just salivates over the fact that the Times is always getting the big scoop. It puts them in a unique position. position because they too find themselves having access to the Pentagon Papers. But the question is, do we publish at the risk of maybe going to jail, of maybe getting disbarred forever, or do we just take the risk and get it out there to the public? And that's the decision that Meryl Streep's character, Kay Graham, has to make, which is the plot of The Post. There you go. Yes.
So in other words, it's a plot about a single decision that might have impacted somebody.
It impacted a lot. Okay. Yeah, it impacted the world.
So the first problem,
okay,
and you probably read this in like 9 reviews like I did, but I was feeling this. Uh-huh. Why is this called? This should be called the New York Times.
Well,
who broke the story? Who put their butts on the line? Yeah. It was the New York Times.
Yeah.
The Post basically stole their story.
The Post is a better vantage point because it's the underdog, right? Like the New York Times is the big chief on the planet right at that point in time. So you want to be from the vantage point of the up-and-comer who's just waiting for their big break, and it's their moment. I think
so
it's
you're
better...
telling me the up-and-comer has dinner in small dinner parties with the former Secretary of Defense?
Well, that's how they present it in the movie.
These are
highly
powerful families and powerful
that's
people.
True.
And to me, it's to have an underdog in that. What a bizarre idea! Which would actually come from people who, if you look at who wrote these screenplays,
uh-huh.
they're powerful people that went to Ivy League institutions. They're not coming out of them to be the underdog is to be highly connected, highly wealthy, be in the right family, and then make a difficult decision.
It's a fair point. And they do bring that up in the movie that, I mean, they point out that Meryl Streep's character is heavily connected with some very powerful people. Tom Hanks' character, who plays Meryl Streep is his boss, but he's kind of like the bulldog of the Post. He's basically the guy who just wants to get the story at all costs, and she's the more kind of prudent type. And we'll get to that because we're going to get to the characters in a second because I really want to dive in. But first, we have to talk about directing because I'm the biggest Steven Spielberg fan that ever lived.
I know you are.
And I actually, sometime I just want to have a whole podcast where we talk about Steven Spielberg for 90 minutes, if that's okay with you, because I love him.
Yeah.
What are you going to say? You have something on Super Chunk? No, okay. Steven Spielberg, listen, man.
Am I going to talk against Spielberg?
No, I hope not.
I have things to say, but am I going to be this guy's body of work is... just awful. We
probably
should have gone with someone else.
Probably the most impressive filmography that you can have. And the guy defined my childhood, right? I mean, Jurassic Park, Jaws, Indiana Jones. This was my 12-year-old life. He was watching those movies every single day. He probably single-handedly made me
and
fall in love with film.
And your favorite film is Schindler's List.
It was that's my favorite Spielberg film. So where do you stand with Spielberg? Because we grew up in kind of slightly different periods.
So one of the things... No, I like Spielberg. Yeah. One of the things that we would... it's funny that he is so... this is something that I was thinking about. I was watching some of his other stuff, right?
Raiders
of the Lost Ark and all these other...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It struck me that in this film, thematically, that there's such delicacy and room made for even historically for a woman who is in power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is treated with such dignity. And then I look at some of these other films that he made.
Yes.
And women are treated and not just women, but it's also some of the other characters are treated like caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
Indiana Jones. Yeah.
Indiana Jones is just full terrible. Of that stuff. Some Jaws to a certain degree,
uh-huh.
but objectification of women and objectification of minority groups,
mm-hmm.
and so I know I'm not I don't tend to jump on this political stuff, but one of the things that really struck me in this film was immediately was what,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and it's okay to to develop artistically and morally. I would say I think we're all that way, right?
Yep.
Don't look at me in the 80s, whatever I was a little kid, but 90s, I don't want somebody to examine that period, right?
Totally.
But at the same time, I'm kind of oh, man, this is a lot.
That's a good observation. Yeah.
So that's just one observation. But your initial question was, say it one more time.
When you think about him, do you have that childhood connection that I have or what?
I don't. I think of him. I mean, I have some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the earlier films I saw as a kid was E.T.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember. I tend to think of blockbuster films. And I think of stuff that is... if you put it, if you were in the 90s and you wanted to pop something in the VCR that would make everyone happy, mm-hmm. you would get something Spielberg. And it would make everybody happy.
Right, exactly.
It's something to pop popcorn to, with the exception of like Schindler's List.
That's not a Friday night date.
No. Right, exactly. But it was that kind of movie where people would be engaged and it really would play. A lot of his stuff plays to our expectations of what would happen in the situations that he develops. Mm-hmm. But as far as... you know, like my favorite films of Spielberg's, I really like Empire of the Sun, and I like...
Oh, yeah. Christian Bale, that was like one of his first as a kid
performances.
Oh, I didn't realize. Oh, so good,
I didn't realize that. I haven't watched it in a long time.
Yep.
So that is really a great movie. And then, of course, I would probably say Schindler's List, Empire of the Sun, and then after that, I would say Lincoln.
I wasn't a huge fan of Lincoln. It was okay. But
so I thought that was a much more nuanced political film compared to what we just saw.
But it kind of gets into Spielberg's later period of sort of little more heavy-handed.
That's what this posting is.
Yeah, I know. And this has plagued him for a while. I actually think his last masterpiece was Munich.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. But
this is like an issue with, like, when you look at a body of work, right? He's mm-hmm. at the tail end. He's 71.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at the end of his career right now. I mean, yeah, he could make movies for another 15 years, whatever. Mm. But you're really looking that he has his formulas. He's probably not going to stray from some of these things. And there is an element of like where he's lost some creativity.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that because it's hard for me to be objective. It's sort of like the same with Star Wars. It's hard for me because it was so integral to my childhood. I never know if it's just one of those things where I can't be objective because this movie meant so much to me then, and how can anything compete with like when I was 12 watching Empire Strikes Back, you know? So like, but I have the same feeling too, that later, that when you get past a certain point, he's coasting a bit, and he doesn't have the punch that he used to have. And I didn't know if it was just me, but apparently it's what you're seeing too. So yeah.
The other part of it is the actual subject, because we're talking about the Pentagon Papers, mm-hmm. which are, you know, it's highly significant, but it's highly significant to people who are like 65 and older.
True.
So I think that where you look at like even like Schindler's List, where you have, which is, I don't compare these two, but these are both historical events. Mm-hmm. With Schindler's List, you have this like war crimes and atrocities that are made very personalized.
Oh, yeah.
Through that film. And then you look at this and there's like, it's not personalized hardly at all.
No.
So you're like... they try in the first scene, mm-hmm. and then they try. Meryl Streep does her best.
She's great.
She does as good as she can. She's, I mean, what great. Else are you going to do to like try to bring some emotion into this to the decision making?
Yeah.
But it loses something there because I think you don't have much audience. I mean, the audience is older that would have emotional connections. This loss of family mm-hmm. member that's gone through that stuff, but like people in our generation don't. Or your generation, mine, or even people who are 10 years older or 20 years older don't have the same emotional connection to Vietnam War. So they don't spend enough time developing that for us to actually have some kind of deep feeling about this.
It's true. Yeah, right. I mean, I didn't grow up in that period. So like when I'm learning the history as the movie's telling it
right,
to me. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think like it's just... Yeah, it's kind of plagued his later movies. We'll see how it goes. He's got Ready Player One coming out in a couple of months. We'll probably review it for the podcast. That looks pretty cool. It's like a futuristic, everybody's plugged into VR because the real world sucks kind of thing.
Your grandfather makes a movie about video games.
Touché.
Player One. Yeah.
But you remember even like some of his kind of minor classics. If you look over, like Minority Report is such a good movie, you know, with Tom Hanks and Catch Me If You Can. And even, I don't know, it's just, he's just such a rich body of work. Yeah, there's a lot of hit and miss over the years, but that's Steven Spielberg. But as far as like this movie, I mean, what does he specifically bring to the table in this that another director wouldn't bring? I mean, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you.
John Williams will show up. Meryl Streep would show up.
He's got the team, right?
Yeah, he's got that dodgeball team all set, man.
and I will agree with you. What is your main criticism of the movie, if your text is any indication, is that there are some moments of the film that are a bit heavy-handed, a bit, I almost want to say too cute. cute, right? Like, especially the last couple scenes where they kind of try to wrap a bow on everything just feels a little too, like, really. But I don't think it's a fatal flaw that covers the whole film. I only felt that in the last couple scenes, but you'll probably disagree, and that's okay. Do you think you thought the whole movie just was a little too
expected?
Okay,
so I would say like it just every you would hope there's enough tension to make you wonder what's around the next corner. But with this, it was like, all right, I know what's around the next corner. Will they go to print?
Right.
Shoot, I don't know if they'll go to print. Maybe they go to print. I don't know if they'll go to print. Maybe they'll go to print. I don't know. This is going to cost a lot more than we thought. Will they go to print? I don't know.
But it's an interesting dilemma. I mean, I got wrapped up in it. I got lost in the world.
But it's interesting than say, like, here's the film that comes to mind immediately to me when I'm thinking about a journalism film that is highly successful that captured my attention.
Yeah.
And connected me emotionally and then also made me feel like I understood what was going on. Spotlight. Did you not see Spotlight?
Well, yeah, of course. I saw Spotlight, but I was very underwhelmed by Spotlight.
See, I didn't feel that way at all.
I know.
I thought Spotlight would actually took you through the process of the journalism. I think it took you, gave you the underdog feel in the sense of it's a small paper.
Mm-hmm.
It gave you, and there was one unit that was like, so there's like six or seven people. Mm-hmm. This film, The Post, it's like, oh, we got 200 reporters.
That's true.
And they're like screaming all the time, you know, and they're typing and everything's going down. This gave you like, well, we've got a small dank room where we're going to try to like blow up the scandal of the last, you know, 40 years. I thought Spotlight, and it has the emotional power of having actual people who are connected to why those documents matter.
Mm-hmm.
And why those stories matter. And then having people who are like conspiring against, who were not the president, but who were very powerful.
Yeah.
And so to me, like that was much more riveting than The Post.
I would think more All the President's Men if I'm thinking of like all time great journalism movies. But yeah.
Because The Post actually broke that story. Not the New York Times.
They did?
Yeah. So it was the same editor, actually. The Tom Hanks editor is the same guy.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he's the editor of The Post at the same time. Because that happens just right after, as they alluded to in the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that you do have Watergate breaks out, and then you have. They kind of set up the Woodward and Bernstein stuff.
Yes.
That's the journalism movie. That's like when you look at, you know, oh, I mean, I guess you go like, there's other ones that allude to journalism throughout the...
Dustin Hoffman, Robert Redford. That's a good film.
This movie, reviewing it, made me go, dang, I gotta watch the other movie. That's the one I wanted.
Right.
It's like if you order like the wrong thing at your favorite restaurant and you're like, oh, I should have ordered this. That's how I felt. I was like, man, I wanted All the President's Men. Let's remake this.
Speaking of remakes, do you know that Spielberg is remaking, wait for it, West Side Story?
Like with Rita Moreno, but someone else now?
Well, Rita Moreno might be in the movie, but like, I don't know who they're going to get. I hope they don't get like Zac Efron or some punk kid to play like Tony, but I...
Isn't that what gang members are?
Yeah, no, I know.
Kids?
No, I know, but like you don't want it to be whitewashed like the original West Side Story, right? Like you had Natalie Wood playing a Puerto Rican.
Really?
Like we could do better than that.
I've seen it like one time.
Oh, it's such a great film. It's my favorite musical except for Hamilton. That is definitely reigns supreme these days. But West Side Story is my second favorite musical, and I just hope he does it justice because it's just great music, and it could be very timely. No, he is not. That's a minor.
See, this is what you get. You get these pet, these strange pet projects. He's like, what haven't I done? And he asks like his personal assistant, you know, I was watching this. And then like, then you get this. Well, do I own the rights? Yeah, of course you do.
Of course you do. And all anyone right,
call up Meryl Streep.
You can think of will make the movie. Yeah, John Williams. Yeah, I'm free.
You know, I don't know if, Daniel Day-Lewis, I bet he's got one more in him.
Oh my gosh. So... Well, here's what makes, I think, the movie totally worth watching. And besides the directing, which admittedly is a little conventional.
That is the word
conventional,
for it.
Yep. If not a bit heavy-handed in spots, the acting brings it to the proper level. Because, of course, Meryl Streep is heading things up. And Meryl Streep's the best. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Meryl Streep is... Like, you know how when you turn the corner when someone is so good that you don't like him anymore?
Yes.
That's how good Meryl Streep is. I'm like, I hate Meryl Streep. Oh, she's so good.
Right.
So,
it's sort of like
turn the corner on even appreciating.
Sort of like the Patriots, you know. It's just like, ugh, yeah, fine. They're amazing, but I hate them. Right?
She's the freaking Bill Belichick of
Every year she's in the Super Bowl. And you're just like every year.
Yeah, you're like, okay, we get it. All right, can you let someone else get a chance? That's how I feel about it. Yeah, really, I do.
I'm with you.
But you also at the same time, you're like, man. Bill Belichick. Wow.
Yep.
How does he do that?
I know.
Besides deflating footballs. But anyway.
Well, let's just leave the cheating
out of
it.
We'll keep it into film. Yeah. We'll keep film here. I know it's Super Bowl, but we'll keep to the film.
21 nominations, this woman. 21 Oscar nominations. And she's won three, but still 21.
Deserved.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. Yeah. And this is her. This is her 21st. So, and here's the great thing about Meryl Streep in the Post. You would expect this, like, head of this newspaper, Kay, is, like, they're going to be this, you know, fearless, like, barge in and tell it like it is. But this character is actually a very vulnerable woman. And Merle plays against type here because, you know, this basically, she was Kay inherited the Post from her dad, and she's surrounded by a bunch of men in the 70s who think that women probably should not be heading up newspapers or any business for that matter. And so she's underestimated at all sides, and it really comes down to her making this decision, and she's freaking out for most of the movie. And I think it's just, it's wonderfully different to see her squirm like that, to second guess herself, to see her in that kind of a role. I like it. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
I like her. She can play, she does so well as her nonverbals that mm-hmm. she brings doubt into it. In fact, wasn't she in the movie Doubt?
Yes, she was.
But she makes you, her face will say one thing and then her words will say something different and her voice will say, she gives you, she makes you nervous a lot.
Yeah.
When she's acting. But I do think, she did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
She played the idea of like, well, I'm not somebody who is capable of having power,
yep,
but is not allowed to. And then somebody who decides to take it anyway.
There's a great scene. It's like one of her first major scenes in the movie where she is prepping for this one moment that she's going to have in this board meeting where she's going to like take the reins and be like the face of the company. And so we see her practicing, and then she gets to the moment and she falters for like just a second, and her boss like swoops in and just takes over and it's like, it just says so much. It's a good scene. Yeah.
So it's like she's second guessing herself and everyone in the room is too. And she's going to, but then she goes and she's going to do it anyway.
Yep.
So that had dynamism to it,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
that had nothing.
It had everything to do with it. It's about the decision. That's what you're just saying. The decision. She's the head of the decision and you feel for her, the trap that she's in.
For her to make her relationship with power
mm-hmm.
is definitely, or women's relationship with power is very contemporary. Of course, that's like something that they're going to write in, especially when you have a scriptwriter as 32-year-old woman. Now, it's true. So that's going to get in there.
Yeah.
And it's also makes the film more relevant. It actually makes it more Oscar worthy.
Yes.
Right. And so almost to the point where you're like, did we check this box Oscar worthy? So I would say, is it an important theme? Yes. Is this the time when women are beginning to step into power to a certain degree
mm-hmm.
in some places? Yes. Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Did she have power already? Maybe. Right?
Well, she does. She just doesn't know how to use it. I mean, there's that point in the film where like, basically like this guy's like, she can't do it. And the other guy's like, actually she can.
Yeah.
Like it's totally up to her. And yeah.
So I like that. I like that tension. Mm-hmm. Now they're bringing the Pentagon Papers into this.
Yeah. Even as you say
and
it.
And I was kind of like,
right.
Basically what I just said, papers, that's their role. Okay, because they're just, but basically the Pentagon Papers role in this film is a bunch of papers, and they usually just move different rooms, and they stack up, and they're important.
Uh-huh.
Okay, everybody?
Yeah.
These are important, and nobody wants us to publish these.
Right.
Should we publish them? But they don't get you. They don't take you into the content very well. They don't show you the. They don't give you any kind of the gravity of what those papers are saying. They try to, but then what are you going to do? Like,
yeah.
Spend 4 hours on that?
Spend 4 hours in Vietnam. I mean, there's a point where.
So can I?
Yeah.
I know, I'm going on a rant.
Do it.
That's why we're here.
Yeah.
So a great film that deals with the Pentagon Papers from, the, I think it's from this year or last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's this fall. Oh, I said from 2017, I think it came out, was the Ken Burns film.
Oh, yeah. Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
And it deals, was on PBS. It,
that deals well with the Pentagon Papers and why it's so politically significant and why... And it gives you a sense of the human loss,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that, and the they might deal with it in one scene talking about humiliation, but I think Ken Burns' treatment of that is much better. Of well, course, it is because
2 hours like versus 16 hours.
It's not, it, yeah, it's like,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. Like the post 2 hours versus like what he had.
I it mean, is, yeah. But it just it shows like at least some. To me, it's like a, enough respect. Like the post is like dividing this into like three different like ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to like mash it all together and then like, you know, sprinkle it with some Pentagon papers. And so what I would say is like, even like Snowden is respecting like the topic.
You dare. Snowden. Snowden isn't in the same league as the Post.
At least you knew what like Snowden was dealing with.
God. Yeah. You're too far, friend. Too far. Let's talk about Tom Hanks, because who doesn't love Tom Hanks? Tom Hanks. If there's anyone in the world that you would want to go out to dinner with,
no,
it would be Tom Hanks.
Really?
This guy, just he's the everyman. He's just the guy. Like, I saw this video. Sometimes I get into clickbait at like 2 in the morning. There's this video of him like crash. Like, he was just jogging along, and there's people taking wedding photos. And he's just there, and he just, and then everyone's like, it's Tom Hanks. And
I'd rather
then he
have
just
Bill
shows...
Murray show up. That's me.
Well, Bill Murray has those epic, like, random encounters. Yeah. Stealing your French fries at Wendy's.
I would prefer Bill Murray over Tom Hanks for that. I just think he'd have.
I would just be, I'd be super intimidated by Bill Murray. That's the thing, because like,
scary.
Yeah,
bit.
It's scary.
Tom
Whereas
Hanks
Tom Hanks
warm.
Would put you at ease right away.
I agree.
Right, exactly.
He seems decent. Well, Bill Murray, there's no chance of decency.
Yeah, Bill Murray might do something like really freaky and then just leave, and like that's just who he is.
And he's
yeah.
probably drinking right? like during the whole interaction, or
totally.
Has been drinking prior to it for hours.
Yeah.
I understand. So I like Tom Hanks.
Yeah, but you don't like him in this.
I don't know. It's like, what haven't we seen of him?
Well, do you think that he's playing a bit against type two? Because he's kind of a bulldog in this movie. He's not afraid of being a kind of a jerk to, you know, Meryl Streep when he has to, because, you know, she's trying to play it safe with the paper is her baby and she doesn't want to lose it, and he's just like, screw it, we're gonna make a name for ourselves one way or the other. So I don't know, I kind of felt like it wasn't like super anti-Tom Hanks. Like, he's played, you know, in Assassin and Road to Perdition, that was definitely against type for him, but like, I feel like a little bit it was stretching too, maybe not as much as Meryl. But
so what I contrasted to Tom Hanks is the Odenkirk character.
Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
Do you know Mr. Show is completely in this movie? You got Bob Odenkirk and David Cross are both in this. So there you go. So Odenkirk, what are you saying? Sorry.
So his, like, he played it so well. He seemed credible as a journalist. Tom Hanks seems credible as like an English teacher that's in World War II or Forrest Gump.
right. You're right there, is that Odenkirk brings that subtlety that it's like you could totally imagine.
There's a little like edge to Odenkirk that made me go, I think Odenkirk could have played this role that Tom Hanks has right here. That's like my first thought. I was like, and Odenkirk plays his role really well.
Yep, he does.
In this. And some of the critics have even been like, wow, why didn't he get more? But there's a certain edge and a realism. Tom Hanks, we get like good feelings, and he draws that, and
yeah.
like, you're always the all American guy.
He's charismatic,
right? But I don't know if you want a paper editor to have all that. I think you want a hard something a little harsher, so that when he delivers some lines about doesn't want to have make the paper have more content for women, when he's like delivering that to Streep.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he sounds like, oh, we don't need that content. Oh, you know, he seems kind of nice. But like, what we needed was somebody that's harsh. And I felt like he's not capable, at least because we have such a catalog in our mind of who he is.
All right.
That he's not going to be capable of being harsh.
You get that a little bit, like in their first dinner scene, you know, where he basically is like, you know, get your finger out of my eye, you know, basically. And he's talking to his boss. I mean, that's what she is. So I don't know. I felt
yeah, but he's still like the conductor of the Polar Express when he's doing that. Do you know what I mean?
Hot chocolate here.
All right, time to the train, Mom. You know? And
love the Polar Express.
Oh, that guy.
Other notable actors, like we mentioned, Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, super cool. Jesse Plemons, this guy was in, he was in Breaking Bad. He was in the, you know, he was the legal counsel in The Post. He was like the head of the legal counsel, but he was also in Breaking Bad. You remember in the later seasons, he was like a part of the new, like, bad monarchy or whatever that took over.
I didn't finish Breaking Bad.
It's okay.
Sorry.
It's all right.
He was in there too.
He was in there. And you might know him if you watch Black Mirror. I don't know if you do or not, Tim, but our viewers, our listeners might. Black Mirror, it was in the first of the new Black Mirror episodes. It was the first one that's like that Star Trek-y type premise. He was the main character in that, and he is like, he's wonderful. And Black Mirror is great, and shame on you for not watching it.
Sorry.
Anyway, it's okay. It's actually very dark and twisted and nihilistic, so it's probably not everyone's
actually,
cup of tea.
His character had spark.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know. I like him. Right. Tim, I want to get into the themes here. I want to dive in. So
all right.
I know that thematically there's a lot of places you could go with this, but what stood out to you, like, initially as like the main driver here? Even theologically, if you want to go there.
Well, I think like I could start out with power.
Mm.
So, and then, I mean, because this gets into all kinds of, like, what is democracy, right?
Yes.
And so, like, you know, I'm a history political science major, so, like, immediately I'm thinking of the role of the press in a democracy. And so, what is the role of the press? Are they there to serve, and they get into this, like, they actually, does the press exist mm-hmm. to serve those in power, or does the press exist to serve those who are governed?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big difference between, say, Russia and hopefully the United States, but maybe not. So there's a very contemporary theme, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the role of the press within our democracy, especially now that we have you have these instantaneous, you talk about clickbait. This is the era of the fake news. This is the era of,
yep.
You have somebody who, like, I see this all the time, where you have somebody who's 22 years old, who's an intern that's basically taking sources, like, not very good sources, not doing any on the field work, and then providing a story about puppies that survived in a rowboat for nine
right.
for 9 days in
yeah.
the Gulf of Mexico, and we're finally rescued. And like, that's the era that we're in. And mm-hmm. how do we discern the difference between that and, say, something that's a real story? Mm-hmm. I think that, like, that came up to me, and that's not a theme of the movie, but the idea is, what is the role of the press in our democracy, especially now? And where you look at the president, and a lot of folks would be like, well, this is a tyrant who's using the press, particularly Twitter. I don't know if I call it Twitter the press. In fact, I wouldn't, mm-hmm. but it's using social media in order to bully people. And using the press to a certain degree, Fox News, stuff like that, to bully
right,
people.
Right. And the attacks on the press are the playbook of tyrants, right? I mean, that's what you attack.
So you discredit the press.
Yeah.
So then nobody. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what you see in dictatorships. And yeah.
I think that's the thing that stands out to me the most, especially when you think about the movie in terms of our politics now and what's happening, is the total attack on truth. Like you mentioned, fake news, and I think what's so dangerous is that we're already so polarized as a nation, and fake news used to mean, like, you know, those fake stories that dude would write in his parents' basement to get you to click on things about, like, you know, based on your zip code, this celebrity's moving in because it's so nice in Milwaukee, you know, and it's like, oh, and then you're like, oh, that's fake. Oh, okay. That's fake news.
Right.
But now it's been used to mean whatever, you know, our president doesn't like. And I think the danger of that is suddenly you might get the idea that everything out there can't be trusted. And I think what the movie shows and what is something we need to remember, is that there are like these institutions, the press, New York Times, Washington Post, these are journalists who don't print lightly, you know, who genuinely want, who are tracking down sources and who are, there was that story where there was a conservative group sent this woman undercover. Do you remember this? This happened like a few months ago. She sent her undercover when all of the stuff in and Roy Moore was going on in Alabama, sent her undercover to be like one of his victims, but like so that she could then point the finger and say that was totally fake when they printed it. But they were fishy about it from the beginning. Like their nose was something's not right here, and they refused to publish it, and they called her out, and she just ran away. But like that just shows you that like this isn't just writers for the New York Times aren't just like taking whatever and running with it. They're actually doing the hard work, and they're working for the people right now. And I just think it's so important that we remember that, so that we don't get into this framework where nothing can be trusted and we don't know what's true anymore. Because if I say 2 + 2 = 4 and you say it's 5 and both are true somehow, like everything falls apart.
So when you're in it, this is like the one of the contrasts here is that you see in this film. Well, there's a bunch of things. One is that they're the IPO. So initial public offering of the Washington Post is like the backdrop of all this.
Yep.
And the idea that the business of the paper might call into question like the ethics of the paper.
Mm.
So, well, if we print this story, then our shareholders can back out of the banks can defund this deal.
Yeah.
So the idea is, well, can you be public? Can you be a public company and then also call into question those in authority, because that might hurt your bottom line?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the relationship of business, the press, and those in power,
and friendships, like they bring up in the movie,
relationships,
right? Whereas Tom Hanks was super chill with the Kennedys, his character was, and Meryl Streep calls him on, was like, "Well, were you really pressing them? You know, when you were cozying up to them?" And it's like, you know, you think of, if you brought up Fox News, I mean, if you think about that, like they're basically there's friendships that are going on between, and there's reciprocity there, and in a kind of an alliance of sorts. Do they feel like they can actually say what is real?
The film asserts is that those are always power relationships.
Yeah, right.
And that there was and that each person was consenting to a power relationship, and if somebody didn't realize that, then they were naive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what the film is pointing out. So I think that to say that, oh, we're just friends and we don't, and this, our relationship doesn't have any ramifications in the realm of power and abuse.
Mm-hmm. And what I print or don't print. Yeah.
Which is like, kind of, because the typical response that I see to this doesn't have anything to do with me. We're good friends. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so you hear this especially with like issues of racial justice. Oh, I got great friends that have this perspective, you know, or, you know, my black friend. And you're just oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so, but the idea being like that your personal, friendships could trump your public responsibility. That's calls into question like individualism, like hyper individualism. So that we tend to, which I think I've talked about before in the podcast, that as Americans we tend to look at like our small group of friends and the people that we work with on a daily basis, and you know, maybe it's like 40 people in our life. Mm-hmm. That's reality.
Mm-hmm.
When we do have a public self.
Yeah.
And so I see that in the film. There is this idea of the public self. That's looking for the greater good of the democracy then the personal self has to take a back seat to that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a point in the film where I think, I'm going to paraphrase it, but Tom Hanks basically says, you know, we have to print this for the people. And Meryl Streep comes back and says something along the lines of, well, we won't have a paper if we print it to get it out to the people, you know? So there's that duality, right? Where it's like, I just think the movie really hits on the fact that truth is super important, that Tom Hanks, he believes that this is something that the American public needs to see. And I think the truth should be a big deal for us.
So the Post, like their, I don't know what you call it, but their motto or whatever is that democracy dies in darkness.
Ah,
So it is about truth.
Yep.
See, it is that the role of the press, and it's probably some Greek philosopher, I just don't know that, that the role of the press would be to shine light.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the press is an active force in democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you see that, you know, I was reading the Federalist Papers and reading Democracy in America in undergrad. And like, I think that is affirmed, is like this role of the press is so vital.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the issues like we talk about is it's been distilled because it was watered down, not distilled the other way around. It's been watered down by so much junk out there.
Yeah.
Cause it used to be, you opened your paper and you see this, you would open your paper and that would be your truth.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And that was, and you know, no matter what the perspective, this is the truth. This is my paper. And people would have a paper that was their paper. So like Washington Post would tend to be more conservative than the New York Times.
And yeah.
And you'd have maybe a couple periodicals and that would be where all your truth came from. Now.
Yeah.
It's anybody that can like, you know, got a blog.
Yeah.
And then the burden, and the burden on the papers is getting higher and higher, less reporters, less direct people in the field, less correspondence. So it's becoming, harder and harder to like, to produce truth,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get to what the bottom of things are. And as it is becoming easier and easier to mask that.
But it's something we have to value. I mean, Jesus said he was the way, the truth, and the life. Truth is the bedrock of what we believe as believers. And you know what scares me, what keeps me up at night in relation to what you're saying, is that with the polarization we have, with all of us getting news from different sources and kind of the overall attack on the media, what happens when something really big happens, right? Like, what happens when there really is a nuclear bomb that hits, or when there's a pandemic, right? Like, that's just millions of people are dying, and you have the Times reporting this, Fox News reporting this, Trump saying this. Like, I mean, that could be the end, right? I mean, no one knows what to believe.
So is there a time where there's issues that you don't want to politicize, is the idea?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, like, when no one knows what to believe and people are dying, like, that could be the end of democracy as we know it. I mean, like, that, like, the ingredients are there. Yeah.
So yeah, but the idea of, like, the press to check power.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So if we have to, so the idea of publishing is the power itself. That comes up in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we get, the movie had a sense of melancholy, which you would get from Spielberg, about the press when the press actually had presses.
Right. Know? Yeah. That's what I love, those shots of like the paper coming off the literal presses. And right. It's beautiful. Yeah.
So you look at any of these, like these social reform movements, and they, you know, in the past, and they all involve the press, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So like you have abolitionist newspapers were huge. Our American Revolution was based in the press. Mm-hmm. And that was a real power. And people, one of the things they would do if they want to suppress something is they'd destroy the printing press.
Yes.
Of the people that were doing that. So that goes into that theme. I think it made this movie's a little melancholy because they keep showing the physical typesetting. Like that becomes one of their little themes they do, because it's like kind of cool.
It is. Like to make the front page, it's like the actual, you have to come up with all the metal words or whatever, right?
Right. Like, yeah. So it's like, so it's almost like this truth is really true back then.
Yes.
Like that's what it's saying. It's like
literally
it's in
stone. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we had to do this and we had to commit wholly to this truth.
Yeah.
And it costs us everything to commit to the truth.
Yes.
I mean, that's what this movie is about, committing to the truth and costing you everything. So when they went to run that, it's like they couldn't just like edit a comment or something, back and go, oh, I screwed that up, or like delete their account. It was out there for everyone to see.
Yeah.
At that point, they could not retract that. I mean, you can retract it, but it was out there. Mm-hmm. There was no going back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is like this desire for that old press to come back within this film. Mm-hmm. Oh, if we only had press like this again. And I think that's legitimate.
But I think out of necessity, we have seen a resurgence in journalism this last year. I mean, and I think it's a beautiful thing. Tim, final thoughts on The Post. Go.
I think that there are better movies out there. I would say watch All the President's Men.
Yeah.
If you want to watch some journalism movies, the other one would be, what am I thinking? I mentioned it earlier. I can't remember the name of the other. Spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
Great movies. I think this movie's all right. I would definitely don't think you need to see it on the big screen. I really see no reason to see it on the big screen.
I'm with you.
And I would hopefully this would lead you into the other movies. Like watch Ken Burns' documentary when it comes out. It already came out, but if it's, you know, it may not be in circulation right now, but it'd be in that in between time.
I'm sure it'll be on Netflix eventually.
Or PBS might have it in their catalog and you can get their app or whatever. But if you really want to get deep into the Vietnam War and deep into the Pentagon Papers and you want to have a true understanding of the grievous nature of this, I would go to Ken Burns and I would skip Spielberg. And I don't even feel like Spielberg's launching us to this. I felt that his treatment of women in power was a little bit disingenuous in this. That's how I feel about it. Because it's something that I think a lot of people are passionate about, but I don't see him. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's some roles that he has for women, but other than that, like I see, oh yeah, well, this is just he's just riding the tide right now of the Me Too and of women having greater access to power or at least demanding it.
What's your letter grade?
B minus.
All right. Well, I liked the movie better than Tim. I will agree there are some problems there. It is conventionally directed. There are some moments that feel a little forced. But overall, I think it's well acted. It's a story that sucked me in. And it's a very timely story in this day and age that really felt like it was important and it was needed to remember the power of truth and the power of journalism. And so I am going to give the movie a B+, and it did make the bottom of my top 10 of 2017. So I would agree with Tim that it's probably not one you have to rush out and pay $13 for, but I definitely would recommend it and think it is worth watching. And so, yeah, there you go. Well, dear listeners, that brings us to the end of our show. And unfortunately, I have some bad news. We are not going to be bringing you a podcast in February. We're taking a month off specifically for the Oscars. As many of you know, I do a huge write-up of the Oscars at the end of the year. It's sort of the crowning achievement of everything that I've talked about and ruminated on. And I love doing it, but it takes a lot of time. And I'm allotting myself a little extra time this month to do that write-up. So we're going to take the month off.
Can I give him homework?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Guys, you've got two items of homework. One is you got to read John's write-up, okay? Because he puts lots of time into it. It's really good. I read it last year.
Oh, thank you.
And that's your first piece of homework. Your second one is you should watch what John and I were going to do, but it's just a lot of time to do this write-up. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
So we're kind of giving John a little space. But what I think would be really good is if you would get what we do in February is we try to go something deeper in the catalog of film and watch that. So I have a homework assignment for you guys.
Here we go.
Whether you like it or not, I want you to watch Fellini's Knights of Calabria. Or Calabria, I don't know how to say her name. It won the 1957 Best Foreign Film Award. And so watch that film and then think, and then you're theological folks, because you're listening to this, think about how that might connect with the gospel. That's like probably the best film I've seen this year. just happens to be 61 years old. But
yeah.
I'd seen it maybe once before, but then I rewatched it and it's just it's amazing.
Fellini, man, 8.5. It's classic.
Yeah, absolutely. This one is well known, but this La Strada is another one. But this one was particularly moving to me recently. So that's your homework.
There you go.
Is that fair, John?
I love it. Okay. You have homework.
It's and only here's, an hour and a half or whatever.
I'm gonna add one more piece of homework, and that is on Oscar night, you want to come to Cinema Faith's Twitter feed. That is twitter.com/cinemafaith, because for the first time ever, we are live tweeting the Oscars, which we usually do, but this time it's not just going to be my voice. No. Tim Nelson and Dan Baker and myself are simultaneously live tweeting throughout the entire Oscar experience on our Twitter feed. You want to be around for that. Tim is going to be bringing his trademark wit all the best in the last couple of years. He was the one texting me all the best tweets, so like he's gonna be bringing it, and then Dan Baker will have his sardonic, you know, sarcasm, like, you know, he's,
you're like, does he mean that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
he does.
Right.
Ouch.
Yeah. and then I'll be the sincere one going, I'm so glad she won, and it'll be perfect. It'll be well rounded.
You can
right?
be likable.
Yeah, right.
The rest of us can be we can just be a bunch of jerks.
I love it.
You're like, wasn't this great?
This is so great. Isn't this a great night, everyone? So that's going to be happening. So you want to tune in. That is March 4th, Sunday night, Oscar night, twitter.com/cinemafaith. You can experience our live tweeting extravaganza, first annual, where it's going to be an every year tradition. It's going to be wonderful. So that's it, man. Tim, it's time to check out for a month. And what's beautiful about it is, you know, other podcasts that usually take off at the end of the year because it's like, and the new year starts a new season. This is the end of the 2017 season for film fans. So we're taking some time off, and then we're going to come back. And in March, it'll be a brand new film season after the Oscars. So I'm excited.
I'm excited
yeah.
too, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I who knows what'll be up?
Exactly. Like 95% of my top 10 came like in between November and January. It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Well, there you
have
it.
Have some guts. Put out a good film in the beginning of the year.
Dunkirk. But in the beginning, wouldn't it be great if like the best film came out in February? Like that'd be awesome.
Know, I'm always watching Who's My Guy? Linklater movies in like February.
Yeah. Everybody
like
wants some.
But nobody else watches them. Yeah.
All right. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you in March.